Great. Sensational. Terrific. What is it?
I told you.
Science. Crimeology.
Are you with me?
Not exactly with you, but somewhere nearby.
Oh.
This is Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. My name is Michael, and what would you do if a year into your project, something happened that ruined it? Would you give up, or would you take the pieces and build something better, like our guest for this episode did? We welcome Danielle Stibbe, a PhD candidate and researcher at the Netherlands Institute for the Study of Crime and Law Enforcement, who's been using honeypots and leaked credentials to study offender behavior and the effects of major law enforcement operations on hacker forums. I find all of this fascinating, so let's not waste any time and jump straight into the interview where I asked her about her start in psychology and how it led her to this line of research.
I think I've always wanted to do psychology. Ever since I was a little girl, I was always the person people reached out to ask about their relationship status or what to do in life. And I was thinking, oh yeah, I'm going to be a psychologist. Then I had the opportunity to study psychology in Leiden in the Netherlands. And I absolutely loved the city. I absolutely loved the studies. I was thinking, well, I want to be a student forever. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do a master. And I signed up to the research master in psychology in the University of Amsterdam. And I was thinking, well, I want to keep doing this. I'm going to look for a PhD. And I looked into different PhDs in psychology. They all didn't really attract me. And then I saw this one vacancy. It had the title, Follow the Honey, Cyber Criminal Decision Making. Coming from a background of psychology, I was thinking, well, decision making is something that I'm already used to thinking about. And cyber criminal is something that I'm interested in. So I think I fit the job.
Was it difficult to make the transition in terms of thinking about problems? How much of what you learned in psychology was useful to you, or did you just sort of have to knuckle down and learn a whole bunch of stuff?
I had to completely restart. I think the only part I didn't really have to restart is the learning how to do it, the learning how to learn.
Right.
I knew how to look up literature. I knew how to look up how I need to learn a new skill. For example, I had to learn Python, which I had some experience in, not a lot, and I completely forgot everything. So I knew how to do that. And having the knowledge on how to program in one language makes it easier to learn in a new language. But I had to completely relearn the entire theory. I had the Oxford Handbook of Criminal Decision Making, and I read it cover to cover just to learn all the basic theories that I need to work with, from rational choice perspective, situational crime prevention, routine activity theory. And coming from psychology, I was thinking of experiments we could do in cybercrime, just with students in a lab the way I was used to, or creating online stimuli and spreading them out on hacker forums. Very ambitious stuff. And then I found out that the path was paved previously. My program had already been started by someone else, and there was a grant with a very concrete set of methods and goals for the project. So I just had to fall in line in a way.
The project that you worked on, it's using honeypots. How did you adapt to that?
So this project was built based on an infrastructure that was constructed by Onapo and colleagues in 2016 that enabled us to create a honey Gmail account. What does that mean? A honeypot is a decoy target for cyber offenders that looks like a real target, but it's actually being held under the control of a researcher, cybersecurity company, or whatever other entity. And honeypot accounts enable us to follow any activity of anybody accessing those accounts. So what that allows us to do is to create these accounts, install the infrastructure in them, and then disseminate their credentials in different ways to see what attracts more attention by cyber offenders. And then we can tell who accessed the accounts, who tried to access the accounts, what they are doing inside the accounts, if they try to send an email, If they open emails, start a draft, delete anything, we can basically see if manipulating the way we disseminate the accounts affects how those cyber offenders perceive and make their decisions about those targets. So what we did in our first experiment was we leaked some account credentials of accounts that were in our control with the honeypot infrastructure installed in them, while manipulating the level of reward that we promised those accounts will be associated with. So for some accounts, we promised that they will have details for PayPal, Steam, those kind of tangible value that you could associate with the Gmail account. And for the other accounts, we didn't mention that. And we also manipulated the number of accounts that we leaked. And what we found was that accounts with that promise of rewards had a higher rate of attempted accesses.
When you said you leaked the details of the accounts, what does that mean?
They use all sorts of methods to obtain those account credentials. Once they get them, they can either utilize the accounts themselves, or they often sell them or share them for free on different platforms. And one platform that is very, very common to do that is hacker forums. And that is where most of my research is focusing on at the moment. You go on this website that you can get into through the clear web. You don't have to use any special software for that. And you see hundreds of posts with millions of account credentials per day.
So you take the Honey Gmail accounts, the details of those, and you put them on this hacker website. You list them on there, and some of them you list as having this account has access to Steam and some other cool stuff that might be worth something. Then you would list other ones just as the details for the account with nothing.
Exactly. And then we found that those with mentioned rewards actually had more attempted accesses. But the funny thing is, a couple of months, maybe even a couple of weeks before the study was actually performed, Google had changed its security measures. So this whole extra step with the SMS verification was a completely new thing. I think that that is one of the reasons why those extra steps were not taken. People were a bit surprised, maybe, by the SMS verification steps, even though it was mentioned in the post, but I don't know if everybody reads everything in a post. And that additional step led to a very low completion rate. So I think out of the 176 accounts that we had in our control, only 12 were accessed eventually. And if you read the grant proposal for my project, it mentions this beautifully ambitious project about what we're going to do after we finish the first step. We are going to manipulate things within the account so that we can investigate how risks and rewards or effort or other types of costs influence decision-making after accessing the accounts. But since we only had 12 accesses and most of them were to the high reward accounts, that entire plan fell through. So we had to rethink our entire project.
That's one of the things with using infrastructure that you're not controlling, right? I mean, you don't have control over when Google's going to decide to implement extra security.
Exactly. It's funny because it took me a whole year to figure out how to operate this whole infrastructure. And then by the time I finished learning how to operate all of it, everything changed again. So I think that's one of the risks of operating experiments online. You can't control the environment you are working in, but that's a bit of what makes it so much fun.
It was interesting that there did seem to be, at least in the attempts, there did seem to be a difference between the valuable accounts and the accounts with no value listed next to them.
Yeah, so that does hint that there was some rationality involved in the target selection. You could argue that all of these attempts were made by bots that were stopped by the second factor verification that Google had introduced. However, the fact that there was an effect on the attempted accesses suggests that at least those bots might have been written with some sort of reward in mind. And since people write bots, at least for the near future, this does suggest that there was some rationality involved in this decision-making.
So it really doesn't matter whether it was an automated process or not. Still, someone has chosen one over the other because they could have more easily written the bots to just harvest every email and attempt everything. You came up against a few issues here. To advance the research, what happened next?
we came up with multiple different plans, and then we went with the, in a way, the lowest hanging fruit. Let's try to get a methodology that we can actually work with. So what we did, instead of focusing on the actual accounts and what happens within them, we went one step backwards in the crime script. So before people try to access the accounts, they have to select a post that they would like to go further with. So what we did was we focused on the post and we manipulated the title of the post in the same manner that we did in the other experiment. But then we looked at interactions with the post. How many people viewed it? How many people replied to it? Did they like the content? And we manipulated both risks and rewards this time. We had 6 different types of credentials, not just Gmail accounts, but we used Steam accounts, Spotify accounts, Amazon accounts. Instead of Gmail, we used Yahoo, since we thought that perhaps people are not attracted to Gmail accounts anymore. And we had a couple other types. And what we did was, for each type of credentials, each specific platform, we analyzed the kind of rewards that people actually advertise on the forum at the moment. And then we used those rewards specifically tailored to the type of credentials. And we also manipulated a risk warning. So we either warned the users that the accounts enclosed might be monitored and that they should use them at their own risk, or we didn't include that warning. So we had a 2x2 design. And then we looked at the engagement figures that we had with the post. And we really found an effect of both risks and rewards. So people were more likely to click, reply, and like posts that had advertised more rewards for nearly all types of credentials. And people were less likely to engage with posts that had a warning in them. But something else happened. And this is another thing that had gone wrong in my project. I think it was about 2.5 weeks, maybe a little bit less, after I started leaking data. And this time, because we were focusing on the posts, we posted way, way more than just 176 accounts. I think we posted 800 or something like that, 880. And I had a very elaborate randomization scheme so that I can make sure to control for the time of day, for the order of posts, for the order of words. I didn't want identical titles. I wanted all the types of credentials to be equally spread so that you can control for that kind of effect. And it was all very calculated. I had been posting in the morning and in the evening at random times. And then one day I go in and I check what's going on with my posts, and I find out that almost 50% of my posts are gone from the forum. So the first thing I do is panic. And the second thing I do is figure out what kind of posts are being removed. Then I find out that, I think except for one, all of my posts with the warning have been removed from the forum. I go to my email, I email my supervisors, and I say, we need to rethink this. Something is going on. And then I remember the day before, my supervisor had linked me to this nice newspaper article about Operation Cookie Monster, which had happened the day before, I think a few hours before all of that had gone down. And Operation Cookie Monster, for the listeners who don't know, was an international effort, I think across 17 different countries, to arrest over 100 people related to Genesis Market, which was a market both on the clear web and the deep web, trading, among other things, with account credentials, which was the product that I was advertising on that hacker forum. And I think the unique thing about Operation Cookie Monster, or maybe it's not entirely unique, but something that is quite interesting, is that they didn't only target admins of Genesis Market or the infrastructure, which they did take down. They also targeted users. And when you are a user of a market, I think there is some sort of an assumption that your identity will be protected. When you target someone's identity and they are disillusioned about their anonymity, I think that creates quite a shock. And I think that was the effect we saw immediately in the hacker forum. So that effect rippled not only within Genesis Market, but across different platforms. So this led us to think, what else can we see on the forum? to what extent did this effect last? How much, for how long did it last? So what we did was we went back into that forum and we scraped everything from 3 months before the operation, so we would have some sort of comparison, up to 6 months after the operation. And then we compared the number of posts per day, but also how did that differ for different types of users? How did that differ for different types of credentials? And then we looked at that as how did the activity on the Hacker Forum changed following Operation Cookie Monster? We also looked deeper into the activity in removal. So presumably, forum administrators or moderators are the ones removing our posts. Those accounts that were leaking the posts that I was using, because they were all unique, I used different accounts for each post, were also getting banned. And interestingly, new tries to post the same kind of posts with the same words were also getting immediately banned. It was immediate. I couldn't even post it. It was basically rejected. So I think there was some sort of a new automation to track and remove those new posts. Again, only for the warning containing messages, so the high risk post. And we kept looking into the removal rate. We have the control condition, all the low risk posts, and we compared those to the removal rates of the high risk condition. What we saw was that not only did high risk posts have higher odds of removal, but forum admins were also more likely to go back in time and remove similar posts. So they were really cautious after Operation Cookie Monster. But this caution reduced over time. We continued the experiment for another 2.5 months or so as we planned. We changed a few combination of words just to avoid those automatic triggers. And then we also repeated the experiment 6 months after the operation to see how the effect may have changed over time. And what we saw was that it did lower over time, but not entirely. Not high-risk posts were still sometimes more likely to be removed than low-risk posts. You can see, if you look at the graph, that there are small spikes, but they were not as likely to go back in time and remove older posts as well. So there was an increased caution. It lasted, but not to the extent it was in the beginning.
So what was in these posts?
I can give you an example. So let's say one post says, I have 4 Spotify accounts. Very simple, very basic post that is very common on the forum. And it's parallel in the high-risk condition would be 4 Spotify accounts, watch out, might be monitored, use it on risk. That's it. Everything else is identical about these two posts. What we had was we had a link to an anonymous file hosting website, which was very common on the forum as well. And that contained a text file with fake account credentials, which we created using automated software.
My guess would be they assumed that that was some kind of law enforcement operation. Either that or they were concerned that their users would spook easily and they didn't want to have anything that even looked slightly risky on their web page anymore, so that they didn't drive off users.
Yeah, it could be either, right? It could be either that they thought, oh, this is another trap, or everybody is so freaked out after Operation Cookie Monster, we need to make sure we have no association whatsoever with this. We're just going to remove everything that reminds us of monitored accounts or honeypots or law enforcement, anything like that. We're just going to move away from it so that our users don't have to think about it. It could be, I don't know what went through their minds. I can only imagine. But the funny thing is that the users themselves also interacted with those posts less. So after I managed to find the ones that do get under the radar a little bit, and after a while, they got a little bit less cautious about keeping them in the forum, the users were still less likely to click, reply, and like those posts. And what I found was really interesting is that they actually did like fake account credential posts with high rewards more often. I found that was very interesting. What was it about it that made them want to like my fake account credential posts?
Because the credentials didn't exist, right? They weren't able to actually go and verify them.
No, all the posts look exactly identical once you go into the post and look at its content, which contains a link to a file with fake account credentials. So
The other thing that's interesting to me here is that it changed over time. It's fantastic that you went back and did the same experiment later.
Yeah, so there was some sort of a novelty effect for the control condition. By novelty effect, I mean that admins were more likely to remove newer posts rather than older posts. And this novelty effect was weaker for the high-risk conditions. But what was interesting is that over time, this novelty effect reduced. So they basically went back to base and only looked at new posts from the last day or so. I can only imagine that they did this irregularly because you can really see the spikes of when it actually happened over time.
It really sort of speaks to the role of perception in the deterrence effect of those kinds of operations. I assume that after time, other matters loomed larger in the minds of the people running these websites than law enforcement without it being in the news. So their risk perceptions might have changed. I mean, without asking them, there's no way to really be sure, but that would be my guess.
Yeah. And I wonder what would happen if this kind of operation had happened again and how a second operation may have differed from first operation. We saw some evidence in other studies that a second intervention normally had lower effect than the first one. So I'm actually curious to see whether that would be the case here as well, or whether the reminder that, hey, the law enforcement agencies involved here are actually capable, you need another reminder, maybe that would actually make them more cautious or not. That's what I'm wondering.
I think it's probably a good point to just let listeners know that as a researcher, you're not working with law enforcement, and the data that you collect is rigorously anonymized. You have no way of tracking anybody. Even if anybody did ask for all of your information, not only would you not want to give it to them, you'd have to be forced, but also there would be nothing useful that they could do with it because it doesn't contain anything that's useful to law enforcement.
Yeah, 100%. Everything I collected is publicly available except for what was inside my own Gmail accounts, but then that would be data that would inherently be available to me if it was my own Gmail account. And I don't have any data about people's identity. I also went through a very thorough process going through ethical approval to make sure that I handle everything ethically and think about all the consequences. But also being in Europe, I am subject to the GDPR regulations, which basically state that I cannot save anything that I don't need to measure and that I shouldn't keep any personally identifiable data if I don't absolutely need it. And I didn't. So all of this data is destroyed. I think the only personally identifiable data that I ever collected was IP addresses of computers that accessed my accounts. And those are deleted. And maybe the usernames of people who had replied to my posts. But I also didn't save those.
Yeah, I just think it's an interesting point to make because criminologists, when they say ethical, that means that the participants of their research, regardless of whether they're engaged in illegal activity or not, are not to be harmed by the research.
Exactly. And I think this becomes a bigger issue when the participants in my study are not aware that there is a study going on. I think one of the things we argued was that we are redirecting them from conducting actual crime. So in a way, we were preventing some small form of crime.
I think doing these online experiments is really interesting, and I think there should be more of it. How did you find the process of running an online experiment versus running one offline or running a different type of data collecting?
Internet use is causing more problems in the form of cybercrime, but it also allows us more opportunities to research. There are theories in criminology that have been assumed as true for decades without real tests in the field. Not to say that the evidence that exists today is not valid and valuable, it definitely is. But most of the research is based on things like semi-structured interviews, like observational research, and that exists in cybercrime as well. But what cybercrime allows us to do is to watch it in the field while keeping ourselves anonymous and the players unaware that they are being watched. So we can watch real crime happening in real life. And that gives the opportunity for observational research, which is very valuable as well. That's something that I also do. But also, it gives us the opportunity to conduct experiments to see how people react to the things that we think they are going to react to. And we can actually test theories in the field with real people who don't know they're a part of an experiment to see what their ecological reaction is going to be. So I think that's really valuable. So it does add some obstacles. You have to think of what else could interact with your data, with your stimuli that you are releasing into the wild. And given that it's wild, things like Operation Cookie Monster could come in and completely mess up everything. And you have to stay alert of the reality you are working with and watch out for how it might affect your data and your participants and what other kind of effects it could have. And luckily, it led to us having a really interesting story to tell, because what it led to was a natural experiment where we have a comparison of before and after. That is a very unique opportunity that doesn't happen very often with law enforcement operations. We just happened to be there right before Operation Cookie Monster happened. Imagine if it was on purpose and we knew what we should measure before the operation. The thing is, with causality, you do have to control for different factors. So one thing we thought of is this forum is English-based, but it does have an international aspect to it. There's a whole lounge that has multiple languages hosted there. So what we were thinking is there's going to be people active at different times of the day. So if we want our posts to be visible at the top of the list, where hundreds of posts are being posted every day, we're going to do this twice a day. And then in order to avoid the whole 9 o'clock crowd that comes back every day, we're going to post at different times. So those are the kind of things that we thought of in order to help us think of what we can expect in terms of engagement with our posts.
So that sophistication happens before you start collecting data rather than with statistical methodologies after.
Exactly. It's in the design. And I would like to say a little word about pre-registration. So we had pre-registered all of our studies on Open Science Framework, where it forces you to think about every single aspect that could go wrong with your study before you start doing things, which is great because you think of all the different scenarios that could go wrong. I mean, I guess not all of them, because there was one that we missed, that you have to adapt to and plan for and essentially create a better design. So pre-registration helped us design our study better and control for all those factors.
Experiments are held up as a gold standard, and I think it's because of their ability to explain causes. Do you think that's true in this environment as well?
I think that experiments are very valuable, but they shouldn't be the only tool that researchers use. A little bit of groundwork before you start experimenting is essential for your experiment to be optimal in the environment that you're working on, especially with cybercrime being drawn as this mysterious thing that always adapts and always changes. You have to know where you're working. And ideally, you work with people with different kinds of backgrounds that could collaborate, and maybe people from computer science, criminology, psychology, law, law enforcement. Ideally, you work together to better understand the environment you're working with. Do a bit of course, literature review, observations, just to understand not only how people react and how they behave, but also what thoughts are behind these actions and behaviors. I don't think I can ever reach that without contacting those people. And in an ideal world, I could just find the people who participated in my studies and ask them, but it's not feasible and probably not very ethical. So I think there's room for all the methods, but I would like to see more experiments online.
So what's next for you? What's the thing that you're currently working on?
So I'm currently working on writing up the paper about Operation Cookie Monster and its effect on the hacker forum. And I am thinking of a fourth study for my PhD. And there are just too many ideas that I have to narrow down at the moment. It's probably going to be an evaluation of a different operation, to be honest. But we'll have to see what the future brings.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to that. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk. And I look forward to the paper on Operation Cookie Monster.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again to Danielle Stibber for sharing her research and her experiences. Nothing ever runs smoothly, and it's good to hear how a bad day can just be the start of a great week. Links to her work are in the show notes, so you can read more there. But in the meantime, this has been Cybercrimeology, a podcast about cybercrime, its research, and its researchers. It's produced by me, but it's only really made possible by the kind guests who share their time and their knowledge. You can find out more about the show at cybercrimeology.com.